All right, well, let's do it. What is up, Kangaroo Chasers? And welcome to another edition of Chasing Kangaroos Live. This is a weird one. We're live on Facebook on the White Lion Fever podcast with Steve Mascord. He's come to the rescue. How are you, mate?
Good. I guess some people might think I engineered this, so the content got moved to my platforms, but it's not the case.
Mate, you do. Anyone watching, you do look like a mad scientist with the hair. You may have engineered it, but mate. I don't mind where we chat, to be honest with you, as long as we can get this out to, I guess, a lot of people that follow me and certainly following you, and we'll chuck this up on the Chasing Kangaroos podcast channel later on as well. But, mate, how have you been? It's been a little while since we've caught up.
Yeah, good. It's been a good start to the year. I spent all of December in the US, and then I was back there in Vegas a couple of months later. I've been to a lot of matches live. And we're just gearing up to launch rugbyleague.com, 24-hour rugby league radio station. So that's we're doing a little bit of inside info for your viewers and listeners. We're doing a soft launch on Thursday, so you'll actually be able to listen to it on Thursday. But a lot of the sort of native programming will come a bit later. I'm learning how to schedule programs for a radio station is a steep learning curve, mate. We start in 3 days, and I don't know how it works, so it's going to be an interesting 3 days.
Mate, yeah, absolutely. You're always doing something different, so I'm not surprised at all. 24-hour radio, how is that going to work? I'm assuming it's not going to be you 24/7, right?
No, well, actually, you know, funnily enough, it's one of the little things I played with when I moved here at the start of 2018. There was a platform at the time, I can't even remember what it was called. It allowed you to load in podcasts and play them out live. And I had a go with that and spoke to a lot of podcasters and got them to send me their podcasts. And it was rugby league on the weekend and rock music during the week. And then the platform went away and it was super, super time consuming. Paul Fares, who has the perimeter advertising at 10 out of 12 Super League clubs, he has a background in radio. He was actually one of those pirate DJs on a boat in the North Sea in the 60s. And so he wanted to get involved and do this. And it just happens to coincide with something that I've been trying to do since I moved here. So we got together and that's how it came about, really. Just a sort of confluence of ambitions, really.
Amazing. I think I may have seen that movie with the pirates on the boat. So that's
incredible. You know what? If you meet Paul, Bill Nighy is the actor in that.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's the movie.
If you meet Paul, he is exactly like Bill Nighy. He's like, if you met him like in the street, you would go, oh, are you that guy, that actor? And he's actually like, he's about the same height. He talks the same. Mannerisms are the same. So it's quite uncanny, really.
That's incredible. Good movie as well. About
The Boat
Time,
That Rocked,
I think.
Is that what it's called?
Oh, The Boat That Rocked is the movie. Yeah. Bill Nighy is in a movie called About Time where all the men in his family can go back into the past.
That. I love that.
Mate, absolute tearjerker. Absolute tearjerker. I love
That's
it as well.
My favorite subgenre in cinema is time travel as a subgenre of science fiction. I try to watch everyone that I can see about, unless it's completely dumb, about time travel. So,
mate, there's a show, we're not here talking about TV, but there's a German show called Dark.
Yes, I watched every episode. I watched it just in the last few months. Yep.
Absolutely phenomenal. If watch it with subtitles, but it's mad. But yeah, we could probably talk TV all day, mate, and movies. But we're actually here because you jumped on the Twitterverse or the Xverse or whatever you want to call it the other day, and you made a post, which to me was really intriguing, very interesting. We had a little bit of back and forth, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to invite Steve on for a live because we haven't had a chat in real life for a little while. But I'm going to read it out verbatim. This is what you said the other day on Twitter. And you say a lot of things on Twitter, so I hope you remember this one, mate. But you said, I think there is very little domestic growth left in rugby league at the elite level in the UK. A solid, successful beachhead in London, the main missing piece. As much as IMG don't seem to be fans of offshore clubs, they provide the only realistic hope for exponential expansion. And I find that fascinating because – to be honest, and you're an Aussie, obviously, as everyone knows from the accent, but you've been based over there for a little while now. And us Aussie rugby league fans, mate, at the moment, it's all about expansion. Who are the next three clubs going to be? It's all about Pacific expansion. The sport is exploding across the Pacific. We've just been to Las Vegas, or you've been there as well, so you saw how exciting that was. So for us Aussie-based fans, I just find it amazing that over in the UK, there doesn't seem to be much growth left, or there doesn't seem to be an appetite, or there doesn't seem to be any hope. And like I said, your tweet fascinated me, mate. So I'd love for you to be able to expand on that and let's talk about it a little bit more.
Well, I've seen Jason Costigan's working with me on rugbyleague.com, and he's just moved to Europe, at least, you know, temporarily for a few months. I don't know what the future, long-term future, but I see Jason saying very similar things to what I did in 2018 when I came here, trying to impose an Australian worldview on British or European rugby league. And it's taken me, I'm not very good at math, but what's that? That's 6 years. It's taken me 6 years to get my head around the fact that this isn't Australia, it's not America, and sport here and the way it's consumed and the way society is structured is completely different, you know. And most people in this country think they know what rugby league is, and they know they don't like it. I mean, it's been here since 1895, and it's been on the BBC in the middle of a Saturday afternoon at times, with massive audiences. And so people, it's not like going to Canada or even going to Melbourne or Perth. You know, I mean, I guess they know what rugby league is, but here, the sport has been here for 129 years. People in London or Cornwall or you know, wherever, they know about rugby league. They know about Eddie Waring. They know about it. They don't like it. You know what I mean? You know, I think there's growth at the grassroots level, and then there's the things I mentioned in the tweet about the league here is not like we think of the league as a bloke behind a desk with a lot of power. The league is just a collection of clubs, right? The clubs don't want Catalans in the competition. They're the current competition leaders. They're charging them to bring in visiting teams from next year, changing the rules on them, basically closing the noose on them, so that Bernard Gwosh, perhaps at some point in the future, can no longer afford to have a team in Super League, at which point they'll be replaced by Bradford or someone like that, or, you know, Wakefield or someone like that. So it is just a completely different paradigm to what we are used to in the new world.
So is the problem, though, Steve, that like every English sports fan knows what rugby league and doesn't care or doesn't like it, or that the league itself doesn't seem to know how to grow? Because you're talking about, yeah, the clubs are in charge, and maybe that's the wrong way to go about it, and we can unpack that a little bit too. But to me, like, if the clubs in charge don't want Catalans there, or they're making it difficult for Catalans, like, that doesn't mean the people of Catalan don't like rugby league. It just means that maybe the opportunity is about to be killed there as well.
Yeah, but you're right, and there's this argument discussion has several sort of subsections. One is society and social and stuff. One is, you know, the state of the game and the politics within the game. And then I guess the third part of the conversation is about resources and what is actually possible. And they all feed into each other. And certainly it'd be great if there was a central policy of expansion, and that, for instance, you know, the RFL went out in the off season and held meetings with rugby union and soccer clubs in potential growth areas and said, okay, you know, what would it take to for you to take on a rugby league team? You know, it'd be great if the political climate within the sport was different and more outward looking. But you know that these clubs, they wouldn't be invited into Super League. They'd be invited into League One, where there's very little central funding. And they are looking at they have said that they do want another team in League One next year. So I'm not saying it never happens, but then you've got this situation of promotion and relegation, which makes expansion, a very risky prospect. I mean, how do you start in a competition where the average crowd is 400 or 500, and have a business plan where the following year you could be in a competition where the average crowd is 3,000 or 4,000, or in 2 years you might be in one where it's 9,000 or 10,000, or like you don't, and also where the central funding varies so dramatically. So I would say that new world style expansion is incompatible with promotion and relegation. It's incompatible because of all that uncertainty. So again, that's another sort of another obstacle, another massive obstacle.
It's a huge point, promotion and relegation, because I always hear, so for example, we've obviously got a club in London in the Super League at the moment, as all of our listeners and viewers are aware. And the one of the biggest arguments I see is, you know, we've tried London for like 40 years plus, and it just keeps not working. London's first game this year, I think they had about 4,000 or 5,000 fans at the game.
More than five, yeah.
More than five. You may have been there, right?
I've been in every one this year, yeah.
Right. So 5,000 isn't a bad crowd for Super League. You know, so there's some Super League clubs that don't get that. So for London to get that to their first game, phenomenal stuff. And it just shows that perhaps there's a little bit of a niche, a little bit of an appetite there. But when London is spending, you know, £1.7 million, you know, compared to other clubs that are spending £3.3 million on their salary cap, for example. So London knows that there's probably not a chance that they'll be in the Super League next year based on IMG criteria, based on promotion relegation. So there's really no incentive for London to have a good crack. We look at the Melbourne Storm. We always compare it to the Melbourne Storm. And I'm going to compare a little bit to what happens over here in Australia, even though I know that the environment for sport is different, that the cultures are different. There are some comparables, right? And the Melbourne Storm has been very successful for a long time. They've been around for over, you know, since the Super League, just past the Super League days, which you've written a lot about. They've won grand finals. They have crowds of up to 20,000, 25,000. They've got a good membership base. They're starting to build a niche. And for the first time in a quarter of a century, they finally have a good junior program, and they're starting to develop Victorian-born players. Now, that's taken 25 years at least. With London,
and at least $80 million, which news,
and at least $80 million.
So news obviously weren't happy with the way they came out of the Super League war, the way they looked, their relationship with rugby league fans, and the Storm to an extent. I'm going to say this, it was a perfect storm in that they had a motivation to fix their image and to do something you know, positive with a bit of corporate hubris, really, to prove that they did like rugby league and they were going to do something lasting and positive for rugby league. And that's why the enormous amount of funding was available. And also they had the TV rights. And so the team was of material benefit to them in that market as well. So that's where we get into the resources part of this discussion. The resources don't exist in British rugby league. Their TV rights keep getting halved. So
I agree. The resources don't exist, and there's certainly not $80 million or £40 million to be spent on a London club. I know that for sure. But what I do know is huge population, at least a small group of rugby league fans that do exist. You've been to every game. You see them there. There is like grassroots rugby league happening in London, even at a small level.
The south of England is far more successful at producing internationals than Victoria probably will ever be. I mean, you have a look at all the players in Super League who speak with posh accents. I mean, Mike McMeekin the other night, you know, played for Catalans. You know, Louis McCartney Scarsbrook. I mean, there's so many of them. It actually is a great nursery for junior players down here in the south.
It's a beautiful thing to see, right? So yes, there's not the millions and millions of pounds or millions and millions of dollars for London, but there are other advantages that, say, the Storm haven't had for a long, long time. And I just feel like if, you know, and this is a comment that comes up a lot, so it's not something that I've made up or I'm saying anything groundbreaking, but when Catalans came into the league, they had a three-year buffer, which where they couldn't be relegated. I just don't understand why, you know, if IMG now, they've got some great plans for the game. If they were to say, hey, look, London is an important part of our strategy. We need a club in London in the Super League. Let's give them 3, 4, 5 years to build something, try and sort of build it, brace themselves a little bit, and then they can enter the promote. Like, because I know promotion relegation, whether I like it or not, I know it's an important part of the fabric of sport over there, for mainly because it happens, it's so successful in the Premier League. So I'm comfortable with that staying, because it's just, even though it's a cultural, it's a sporting culture, I don't personally understand. But surely we can give London, surely London is an important strategic pin on the map, important enough that we could sort of give them 3, 4, 5 years to build up to something special so that they have a chance to actually grow. Because, you know, we've had London for 40 years or so, up and down, up and down, up and down, but we've never really given them the opportunity to do it right.
So the IMG gradings and the structure, you know, basically the medicine is, it's from my way of thinking, the medicine is the end of pure promotion and relegation. And in order to get the clubs to swallow it, they had to put in a lot of sugar, right? And part of the sugar would be, that would be too sour for the other clubs. It'd taste too bitter. They'd spit it out if they were saying, we're going to give London some sort of tenure, guaranteed tenure. What London do have is they get benefit. They should. And again, it's down to local government areas, and it's being negotiated, I believe, again at the moment. But London have a massive catchment area, the biggest catchment area in the country. They should get and the best London can hope for, and I think it is what they hope for, is to get more points for their catchment area and have a larger area included as being theirs. At the moment, it's down to local government areas. It's completely determined by that, and so London don't get all of London. Basically, so if they get recognition for their entire catchment area, as we understand it, then that's going to really, really help them. But I just don't think they would have. They got the turkeys to vote for Christmas. They actually did get the turkeys to vote for Christmas, and I think guaranteeing London anymore, or any club anymore, the vote wouldn't have gone through. So I think they did what they had to.
How did Catalans get 3 years right at the beginning of their Super League life?
It was a different environment. I think Maurice Lindsay was still around in the background then, and there were different characters and more sort of charismatic and persuasive people involved, as I understand it. And also, with Catalans, you know, there was a belief also that it would strengthen the French test side, and now all the clubs are going back and saying that hasn't happened, and also they thought they'd get TV deal out of France, and they didn't. So the clubs now are tightening the noose on Catalans, because to them it hasn't delivered on what was promised. And also, you know, Bernard has like some amazing 1,200 corporates at every home game, and they're jealous. So, you know, they don't. So they're going, well, here's this club that didn't deliver on the reasons we admitted them, and they're making a heap of money off our content, and then we're making nothing off their involvement. So they want to hit them. They want to hit them and squeeze them. You know,
it's interesting. You know, we just talked about it took the Melbourne Storm, you know, 25 years to start to get juniors and things like that, and I think you can say, I think you have said in the past, Melbourne are the example of expansion. It's the example of expansion done right. We haven't really done expansion, so to speak. Everywhere we've expanded to successfully have already had some sort of rugby league played before, like New Zealand or south of France, for example. Catalans is similar. They've been around for about 25 years as well. And now we're starting to see the TV deal in France. Now we're starting to see, and Dean Williamson over on your White Line Fever Facebook page, you just commented that this week gone had an all-French spine for possibly the first time ever when Abdul went off. Just a positive stat for the French.
And so we're starting to... The best players in that performance were French players, you know?
And that's something we're seeing more and more. This is arguably the best side at the moment in Super League, you know, depending on what week it is, but dominated by French players. So we're finally starting to see the fruit. You know, we couldn't expect it to happen in 1, 2, 3, 5, 10 years, but 20 years later, we're starting to see it. And just as it's just so typical rugby league to me that just as we're starting to see the fruit of Catalans paying off from a French rugby league and from a TV deal perspective, we're about to try and kill them by making them pay for everyone to pay for everyone's flights for their home games. It's just ridiculous to me.
It's an indication of where the sport is at. We go back to the resources part of the conversation. You know, the sport's struggling and basically they're looking to squeeze a franchise that is successful and is making money. And, you know, like, look at Toronto. I think Toronto went without any TV, any central funding at all for their entire existence. And when COVID hit and they were in a bit of strife, I think they needed a loan of about 16 grand from each of the other clubs just to stay afloat. And the other club said, no, you know, we're not loaning any money. It's take, you know, because the sport's impoverished.
It's funny, yeah. Like, a lot of money was spent on Toronto. And when COVID came around, if COVID didn't happen, who knows where the Wolfpack would be right now. But I sometimes think they're punished for spending all that money at the start. And I also sometimes wonder if they were like the London Wolfpack spending that sort of money, then maybe we'd see something different today as well. But France is interesting, and the south of France is interesting because what I've seen the NRL do successfully is, and I mentioned this on Twitter in response to your comments as well, but what I've seen the NRL do very successfully over the last couple of decades is they've built the heartlands and they've built the brands to a point where it's almost unbreakable. And they're now in a position where they can expand. So back in the days when you were writing about Super League wars and things like that over here, the clubs were in a position, and the Sydney clubs in particular were in a position where they needed to, a lot of them needed to either relocate, merge, or die. That was like all over the papers, you know, 20 years ago, post Super League war. And some, you know, six clubs decided to merge. No clubs decided to relocate, even though there was tens of millions of dollars on offer for them to do so. But all of that talk is in the past. Like, there's no more of that. The Sydney brands, you know, are strong. You can support the South Sydney Rabbitohs from Campbelltown. You can support the Parramatta Eels from, you know, the Northern Beaches. You can support St George Illawarra from Southeast Queensland. It doesn't really matter that much. The brands are solid. And when the NRL looked at expansion for the first time in a long time, instead of going to Perth or across to New Zealand again, they chose to go to Brisbane or Redcliffe, right? So they've got another Southeast Queensland team. And at the time, I ridiculed that. But I've since seen, and a lot of us, like myself, have seen that we're actually wrong for ridiculing that, because what the NRL did successfully there was solidify Southeast Queensland, the strongest, really the heart of rugby league in Australia. The crowds have grown since then. The TV ratings have grown since then, because when you have a Brisbane team or a Queensland team on TV, those typically rate the highest. The Broncos, who didn't want another Brisbane team for so long because they thought it would eat into their part of the pie, well, they were wrong too, because you throw in another Brisbane team and now there's calls for another Brisbane team again because it's just been so successful. But the NRL, after building for decades, building the heartlands and getting back to a point where it's probably the biggest sport in Australia now, and AFL fans will argue, but they're pretty much on par depending on all the different metrics. You know, AFL wins on crowds, NRL wins on ratings, et cetera, et cetera. But we're at a point now where the NRL is strong and they can expand. They can start talking about Christchurch, Perth, Papua New Guinea. And a lot of these areas, like, you know, New Zealand is not, you know, new to rugby league. Perth kind of is-ish, you know, so we're talking expansion again, but it's taken time. And I just don't see that sort of time taken over in the UK. And I guess that's where your point's coming from, right? They don't have the time to sit back and invest time and money because the time and money isn't quite there.
Yeah, that's down to resources. But also, like, you know, the clubs have to vote for everything. So when the championship clubs are doing they get approached for TV rights for on Premier, the league don't decide, yeah, we'll do that. Yeah, we'll take the money. Oh, that's not enough. No, they go to the clubs and ask the clubs. And the clubs don't, the West Yorkshire clubs don't want to be on TV. They either think it's not enough money, it's going to impact their gates. And so the power is not at the centre. If there's no power at the centre can't be strategic, you know, and the power is with the clubs. And, you know, the clubs, rugby league was invented when clubs voted to do something in 1895, not when an entrepreneur came along and decided, you know what I mean? So that's, you know, it just doesn't work that way. And the clubs don't want someone, as we're seeing with Catalans, the clubs don't want someone better at leveraging their IP than they are. You know what I mean? You know, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, like people want Catalans out. They want rid of Catalans. You know what I mean? Like, you know, so it's just a completely different paradigm. And you know, mate, we could sit here all day and talk about the way the British, you know, see sport. And even though their biggest teams are full of foreigners, they live in gated communities and earn hundreds of thousands of pounds. They still see sport as basically being me and my mates against you and your mates, and anyone could be successful. And you know, there's this sort of group delusion about the purity of sport. You know, that it's pure and it's got this innate sort of dignity that can't be sullied by getting rid of promotion relegation or by a draft or by a salary cap or, you know, like, and it's just basically superstition. To me, it's they have a British have a superstitious worldview when it comes to sport. It's you know, so and it's very hard to break down. But if you take that away, then often you take away a lot of the good things with it. So it's just not Australia. It's not America. It's just so different, you know.
It boggles the mind. And look, the romance behind that, I like it, right? I understand it. I get that. And I love how in the Premier League, you know, theoretically, you can go from the bottom all the way to the top. Theoretically, it's probably impossible, right? But theoretically, the romance is alive. It's just so different in the Premier League, the biggest sport, probably the biggest sporting competition in the world outside of maybe NFL, NBA. It's a different thing to like rugby league, which is struggling to survive. You know, to go from the bottom to the top in rugby league, there's not that much of a difference between the bottom and the top in some cases.
When you can drive everywhere too, the idea of catchment areas, population, demographics, all that sort of stuff, when you can drive everywhere, that becomes a very abstract idea because, you know, the idea that, you know, we wouldn't have a team in Perth and then a team in Cottesloe or, you know, or Northbridge or, you know, it's stupid to us, right? But to the British sensibility is, if Cottesloe can beat Perth, then they deserve to be in the competition. You know, like because there isn't all that extra resource needed to get the team together and to get them to away games and to bring the other teams in. Because here you can drive everywhere, and this sort of and also just the way that, you know, the history of the way settlements grew, that London is actually a group of towns that grew together, that eventually came together. It's not like in the New World where we set up a town and it grows outwards. So they don't think of sports in terms of franchises, big cities, entertainment, business, the way we do. They think of it as like when those teams started, they were basically we use the word clubs, right? And we just take it for granted. We don't think about the word clubs. But they were literally gentlemen's clubs. It was literally you and I go down and we kick a ball around and we play, I don't know what they played in the 19th century, backgammon or something. And then one day someone said, oh, why don't we play backgammon or kick a ball around with that other club over there? And then they started playing them regularly. And then a third club and a fourth club, and then they eventually had codified sport, right? So they don't think of sport the way we do. They think of it very differently. They think of it as my neighborhood competing against that neighborhood for our honor, you know. And the idea of a league as being a kind of controlling body that tells the clubs what to do, it's not so obvious here because it started with the clubs. It's bottom up. It started with the clubs. And the league is just there to organize fixtures and referees and suspensions. Yep. The league's not there to tell the clubs where to go or to set up a club in a new place, because the clubs is where it comes from. You know what I mean? So it's just a different mentality.
So is there any way, I've got so many questions, man. Is there any way that mentality can change? Can it be broken to the point where a whole bunch of fans will say, fuck this? You know, pardon the French. But then 5-10 years later, they all come back.
They're trying
back
to
again.
Pardon the French at the moment.
They're trying to pardon the French. Yeah, but is it possible to change their mentality? Or on the other side of things, should the London Broncos be called the Wimbledon Broncos, so they have like more of a town mentality, like rather than this whole city mentality? I don't know, there's probably so many ways you can spin it.
The problem with that would be that they'd be changing their name all the time because they move all the time. They've had so many home grounds. You know what? I think it can be done if someone comes in from outside who doesn't accept what I've come to accept, you know? So people talk about the NRL coming over and getting maybe a stake in rugby league commercial. You wouldn't buy the game. I mean, because the game is a government-funded public asset, you know? So you can't just sell off a government-funded, you know, public asset. But the actual rugby league commercial, which runs the commercial assets of rugby league, the NRL could invest in rugby league commercial, but I think they would get their ankles caught in the seaweed a little bit if they did that, and it would eventually drown them, because I think the only way they could do it would be to actually, and this is going to sound rabble rousing, but I think the only way they could do it would be talk directly to certain clubs, progressive clubs. So I'd say Catalans would be disgruntled. See, here's the interesting thing, right? Toronto got involved in British Rugby League because it was easy to get involved because there's no bureaucracy, right? You couldn't, if they went to English Rugby Union, the Canadian Rugby Union would go, hang on, you can't do that. You can't go over our heads, you know? Rugby League has no structure, barely present, and is kind of poor. And so David Argyle could say, I'll throw a bunch of money and we want to enter the British Rugby League structure. The Catalans in the opposite position, right? They are stuck with British Rugby League because of the scarcity of rugby league in Europe. They don't want to play rugby union, right? Because that everything they stand for is not rugby union. So the clubs in the north have Catalans over a barrel, okay? Because there's no other rugby league competition they can enter. So for the NRL to get involved in European rugby league effectively, they would be better off dealing directly with progressive clubs who do believe in a more American franchising system. You know, I know Leeds are a very progressive club as an example, and to me they're the best club to go to and visit and see. That, you know, they're one of the few big city clubs, and they've got a great stadium and a great CEO and ownership structure, and they teach their players to be respectful and all that sort of stuff. Great culture, and so, you know, if for instance, Leeds and Catalans started doing stuff directly with the NRL, I know it would really upset a lot of people here, and they might get voted out, but maybe with Catalans that's going to happen anyway. But I think then the NRL would be able to be more Australian in it, and it'd have some leverage, and it would be able to institute some more new world structures on the sport here. And those that didn't want to do that could stick to what they're doing now, you know. But I think if the NRL got directly involved in rugby league commercial, I think that too much Englishness would kind of like dilute their intention, you know, and dilute their kind of vision. So anyway, that's my thought on that. Yeah.
I think you're starting to touch on something very interesting. And I don't know how possible any of that would be. That would be a massive risk for the NRL. And
it's rebellious. It's basically
very rebellious.
It's starting a Super League war here.
You're looking for your next book, Steve. Happening. But I could see the NRL doing something if they were to do something along those lines. And like I said earlier, what they've done very well is establish themselves to an unbreakable position in the heartlands before they can expand. And there's certainly like good, strong bones for rugby league support over there. So we joke about the M62 a lot, but if you go from St. Helens and Wigan and Leeds all the way to Hull, there's some good rugby league support along those lines. There's good rugby league support in the south of France. There might even be good rugby league support in little pockets of Wales, for example, right? So there's probably little areas where you can go, okay, there's enough history for rugby league where we can make, you know, 8 to 10 really decent, strong clubs in a similar way to what you're talking about. It boggles my mind that you can have, you know, such a, like the most successful club in Super League history in St. Helens, just outside of Liverpool. But like Jack Welsby can walk through the streets of Liverpool City and no one knows who he is. I find that absolutely crazy that we haven't penetrated the Liverpools and the Manchesters. Is it easier to start close to our doorstep on the M62 than it is to be talking about London's and Cardiff and Dublin and things like that?
Maybe, but here's another way to explain it is that let's imagine that rugby league is the biggest sport in New South Wales and Queensland, but there's no Sydney or Brisbane.
Yep.
So because rugby league is actually played not in the big cities of the north, with a couple of exceptions, but in towns on the outskirts of the big cities. So what you're trying to do is take something that is played, is super popular at Penrith, but the rest of Sydney doesn't like it or is not into it. You're trying to take it into town and try to when the clubs are living hand to mouth anyway, you're going to lose money. If you know, I know that the world, you know, World Club Challenges, cup semi-finals, test matches have gone to Anfield and gone to Liverpool, and they kind of do work as one-offs because people travel in from the heartlands. But to sustain a club, we go back to your mention of Melbourne. It's cost, you know, $10 million a year or whatever it costs. You know, cost probably getting close to $100 million now, $80-90 million. And that was because News had a motivation. So there's no one with the motivation. And again, clubs start here in the area. When someone get, they don't, head office has, head office doesn't do that here. You know what I mean? So there's no catalyst for that to happen. There's no reason why it would happen. There's just no reason why it would happen.
We almost saw, what was it, the Lions over there, Swinton Lions a couple of years ago, looking at a complete rebrand to Manchester Lions. And like, they were so excited. A lot of expansionists were excited.
The board got voted out.
The board got voted out.
We're not Manchester. We're Swinton.
Immediately.
Yeah. We're not Manchester. We're Swinton, even though they weren't playing in Swinton and hadn't played in Swinton for years. They're still like, you know, the supporters who come in their hundreds, not thousands, you know, every second week, you know, they have power over the clubs, and these clubs that only have a few hundred supporters have power over the league. You know what I mean? So it's the pyramid is completely upside down compared to what we understand.
It's crazy. I can start to understand why you think the way you do, and it's taken 6 years for it to be sort of drummed out of you. You made, probably one of the final comments today, because this has been a great combo, Steve, and I appreciate your time, mate. Towards the end of your tweet, the original tweet that spawned this conversation or this discussion, you mentioned, I'll read it again. So as much as IMG don't seem to be fans of offshore clubs, they provide the only realistic hopes for exponential expansion. Where do you mean when you say something like that? Where are you talking about?
I actually think it is possible to do the things you are suggesting as long as you leave England.
Yeah.
I think it's possible if you get, I you know, because when people don't have any idea what rugby league is and they don't have a prejudice against it, they have an open mind. So I think it'd be far easier to have a team in Rotterdam than to have one in Liverpool, you know, because people don't have that that prejudice. So if you had, you know, a good owner, you bought in. And I'd also hear there is also this belief, again, which we saw in Brexit, this kind of like national borders are so important, like so you can't have, why would we have a team in another country? It doesn't make sense. Because there's no precedent for it in other sports here, but it's because rugby league is small, and people here say to me the New Zealand Warriors should leave the NRL and set up their own competition, because national borders just seem to be so ingrained as being like just a canyon, you know, here that we don't want. Why don't they have their own competition? Because soccer obviously is big enough everywhere that you can have your own competition in every country. But we know that it's about money. It's about money. So if you can make money joining a bigger competition and you can draw bigger crowds through the expenditure and you can get bigger sponsors and you can get on TV, then you do it because money dictates you do it. And that's what I talk about, the delusion here. I say professional sport is in the business of selling you the illusion it's not a business, right? And no one swallows that illusion more than the British. You know, they you know, they don't believe it's a business. They can't accept that sport is dictated by money, even though there's so much money in sport here. So I think well, Catalans are successful, right? They don't give enough back to the British game, but they're successful in and of themselves. And Toulouse can clearly afford to fly in visiting teams, even though the crowds aren't massive. And they also, they've had, you know, they've been in Super League, so they've been successful. So I see them as beacons of the future and where expansion is. I know Jacksonville, you know, New York, the Challenge Cup draw was going to be in New York when COVID happened, right? And New York were going to compete in it the following year. Jacksonville had a very well resourced business plan, which impressed a lot of people to play in League One and followed Toronto's example and worked their way up. And then again, COVID happened. And IMG don't like offshore teams. They were happy to limit the number of French teams in Super League to two, maximum two. Even if Carcassonne come in future, they all three will not be able to be in Super League under the rules. And I guess that's some of the sugar that was in there to make the medicine go down to get the vote to get it through, but I see that the British game still has IP that is attractive to offshore identities because it's small and it's cheap, right? It's cheap.
Mm-hmm.
So you couldn't get involved in the whatever that European rugby union competition is, I don't know what it's called, but you couldn't afford to be in that, right? But you can afford to be in the British pyramid if you are Carcassonne, or if you are, who knows, Red Star Belgrade, or if you are a team in Holland or whatever. So that's why I said that, is that all those factors I've been boring you with for the last hour. They don't so much exist in other countries because they don't know what rugby league is. They don't know that they don't like it. They don't know who Eddie Waring was or any of that sort of stuff. And so you can have this shiny, bright, new, outward-facing facade to the outside world. We know what it's like inside. Yeah, we know that inside you can't do it, but you can appear to be progressive and glamorous and desirable to the outside world, and you can get other people involved. So, you know, I think, for instance, North America to me, I mean, people say, oh, transatlantic doesn't work. It doesn't. It doesn't work with one or two teams. But if there were six, you know, and they had their own TV deal, then the RFL Rugby League Commercial and IMG, if they could annex, you know, North America, they could as part of their territory, and it would bring it. And to me, it's got far more legs than Central Manchester or Liverpool or Birmingham or any of those places, because those places, as I said, they know what rugby league is and they're not that interested in it, you know?
You might be right there, man. I mean, Toronto is a great example. From nothing, we had 10,000 people going to every game and they had some phenomenal support.
The first time I arrived there for their first game, turned on the TV in my hotel room and there was a news report about them. They hadn't played a match. People marched to the game with flares and drums. They didn't know what they were going to watch. They had no idea. They thought, you know, like they're just open. There's just an open society, enthusiastic society, you know, just so, you know, different to here. I'm not saying it's a great place to live. I love living in London, but I tell you, if I go down the pub here, you know, which I do sometimes, you know, there's never any rugby league on. No one knows what it is. You know, like, you know, they're packed for the Six Nations. You know what I mean? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Packed.
Yeah.
But I can walk to the Broncos from here. But I went to the barber last week, as I'm sure you know, to get the beard. How often do you go? But I went there last week, and the guys in there. It was a Lebanese guys. And he went to the World Cup. He's like, I didn't know we had a rugby team, but we've got a rugby team. And I said, and I was in there last week and I got him again. And he goes, so what's happening? Is the Rugby World Cup in France? And I said, no, it's not going to be in France. He goes, oh, I was looking forward to going to watch the Cedars. I was looking forward to going. And I said, Abbas Miski's going. Well, he goes, Miski, they win the world championships. And I said, you know, he played. You can walk to the London Broncos ground here. He's like, what's London Broncos? I said,
wow.
I said, Abbas Miski, he played there only a month ago. He goes, really? He goes. I said, you should go. He goes, oh, big football weekend this weekend. No, I can't go this weekend.
No, you can't.
And so, you know, that's the thing. Like in London, like I see more rugby league gear in the street here and at the gym than I see football gear. Like. Much more, because there isn't that American merchandise culture in soccer where you buy the beanie and you buy the rain jacket and you buy the pants. And rugby league people in London like to wear it as a badge of honor. So they'll wear their St. Helens shorts and their Parramatta cap and whatever. And you know, to stand out, to go, this is my tribe, you know. But it doesn't translate to going to watch London Broncos. Never has.
That's crazy.
And
You've touched on a part of Australian culture that's similar to English culture. All barbers are Lebanese, and they're all Lebanese over here as well. but maybe you've touched on something else there. So in London, they'll watch the Six Nations. They'll pack the bars to watch Six Nations. But we keep hearing over here anyway, and you can probably shed some more light, but a lot of the London-based rugby union clubs are dying. You know, they're going bankrupt.
Well, that's on a national level. I mean, they got a heap of funding from what's it called, capital investment, and they just blew it. I mean, they like we did in rugby league 25 years ago with the Super League money, blew it. You know, so yeah, the clubs, the rugby union is the national team is very popular, and international rugby union is very popular, but at club level, it's struggling, yeah.
So do we need more internationals? Is that something
totally.
That
this
can
guy,
help?
I mean, anyone watching in England, even on replay, hello, if you're watching in a week or a month or a year, will tell you that that is the only way to break through here is to get going. And that's why the cancellation of the World Cup, because it was a dead month in 2021, was so damaging, because that Saturday afternoon time slot on the BBC with the whole country watching is just priceless, you know, for the sport here. And people won't be cynical. I'll tell you what, people won't be cynical. They might watch Super League and go, that's pretend rugby. It's not real rugby. It's fake rugby, I've heard it described as. But I don't hear that if it's a Saturday afternoon in autumn and England Rugby League are playing, they don't suddenly go, oh, this isn't real rugby. They go, they'll be into it, you know. They'll be totally into it, and they've got less cynicism than we do too. I think they don't go, well, it must be crap if we lost to Samoa. It must be a terrible sport if Samoa can beat us. Or what's the point of them playing France and winning by 70? It's a waste of time. Which we say, we don't say the first one, but we say the second one. The general sports fan here will go, oh, we beat France by 70. Did you watch that? You know what I mean? Like, it was like, so their attitude towards the national team and towards towards international sport is less critical than we are within rugby league, I find, you know.
It's low hanging fruit to me, man. Play France every year.
Look,
you know?
Someone said to me the other day on social media, why don't we play test matches? Oh, because the English game went to summer. Please. I mean, they will stop their competition for a World Club challenge. They allow Wigan and St. Helens to defer a match for a month so they can go and play at Penrith, or so they can, you know, so they would, if the game was played summer, winter, spring, autumn, to get international competition up and running, they'll move heaven and earth to do it. It's because the club game in Australia became so valuable that we don't want to allow players to risk injury by playing too many internationals. These guys are like, what? They're like U2, you know. You know, are they going to let U2? Are U2 going to go and play at the Open Hearth Hotel at Warrawong? You know, like, no. They're too valuable. And having Nathan Cleary come over and play on tour against Halifax and stay here for two months is just it's driving a Rolls Royce on a dirt road. It just doesn't make any financial sense. That's the reason the tours don't happen anymore. It's money. Again, it's money, you know.
It's always money, mate. And I think that's probably the best place to stop it. Hopefully we can get hopefully we get some oil over there this year. We'll hear something soon, surely.
I think it'll happen. I think it's great. The NRL are now kind of taking an interest in international rugby league for one reason or another. And I think the Samoa have been told you can't play in our comp down here, and probably they'll throw in some money to make sure that the Samoa come up here, and a round of applause for the NRL for doing that, you know.
Let's hope so, Steve. I'd love to see it, mate. And hopefully we can see some more growth over there. I know it's tough, but, you know, who knows? Maybe in 5, 10, 20 years, we'll see a few Melbourne Storms pop up over in the UK. We'll see what happens.
Cornwall, mate, in Super League. Cornwall
we'll
in
see Super League. We'll see Cornwall all the way at the top. They can make it. They can start from the bottom and go all the way to the top, mate. But Steve, it's been good catching up, mate. Thanks for chasing kangaroos with me, buddy.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks for watching. Bye-bye.